Italians take weddings really seriously. I went to one last night, and besides the fact that there was more food than, like, enough food to jam a wood chipper, it was just, like, non-stop.
Well, you've seen the gumbo.
You know what? It was a lot like this. It was, like, the line and just the people. I was like, it's almost like it's a contact sport.
Yeah.
It's impressive, really. Considering I married an Italian girl, I sort of feel shortchanged.
Well, you didn't get the whole...
You didn't go
full Godfather.
No, I didn't go full Godfather, because my side's not Italian,
That's too bad. Well, true.
That, if you're wondering why I sound a little rough this morning, there was an Italian wedding in my history very, very recently. Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada. You are listening to episode 99 of The Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca. Your home for cinematic passion and perspective. It has been a strange road to get to episode 99. We were at first on this episode going to talk about The Wolf of Wall Street, and then that got moved, and then the fallback was to talk about Alexander Payne's Nebraska, and that got moved. So for a moment or two, we didn't know what we were talking about. So I turned the microphone over to my listeners, and I said, okay, folks, here's half a dozen movies that are coming out in smaller theaters and on DVD and whatnot. What would you like us to talk about? And people voted, actually. I thought I was going to get, like, three votes. I got, at least 100 people chimed in, and they voted on a film that we're going to talk about today, which is cool, because I've never done that, like, by request kind of thing.
Just do it more often.
I was going to say, I might start bringing that in every once in a while. And of course, I don't do these sorts of things alone. We have a guest today. Corey Atad is with us. How are you this morning, dude?
I am all right.
It's an early show again, so I'm always appreciative of people.
That's okay. I'm a little tired watching Saturday Night Live yesterday.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, I watched that before we started today, yeah. and that was pretty good. That was worth the wedding hangover. On episode 99, we will be discussing Broken Circle Breakdown by request. We'll be finding out movie endings people would change and turn the record over to play the other side. Before we get into any of that, if you can count, you know that episode 99 will, of course, be followed by Matinee Cast 100 in 2 weeks' time. And I would urge you to tune in. We have something special planned. We're not going to be doing a review. So if you're worried about, you know, what might be out there that you haven't seen yet, don't worry. We are going to be doing a lot of fun things. But 100 shows over 4 years. I'm really, really proud of that. And I would love it if you would tune in 2 weeks' time. But first, back to the matter at hand. We need to learn more about Corey. This is Know Your Enemy. So Corey is a two-time guest. His first appearance back on episode 65, we learned that the first film he could remember actively seeing was Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls. The last film he'd watched at the time was Punch Drunk Love. The worst film he'd ever seen was Across the Universe. I imagine that answer has changed in a year or two. The unseen classic or essential was Tokyo Story, which you've seen now, because I gave you a ticket to that.
I have. Yeah, that's right. You gave me the ticket. Yeah.
How'd you dig?
I liked it a lot, although I have to admit I will need to watch Morrozu and then probably come back to it because it didn't hit me the way that I expected it to.
I'm worried now because that's going to be my last blind spot for the year.
I mean, it's an excellent movie. Yeah, it's
you want to build
a very particular, style from that director.
Okay. And the film he wished he had made was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Time for round two. Corey, what is a film you like that nobody else does?
Okay, so I mean, a lot of people do like this movie.
Okay,
but I have to talk about War Horse.
Okay,
I can't not talk about War Horse. Okay. It has to happen. You know, when it came out, I think people were generally pretty positive about it, like to the extent of going, oh wow, that looked like it was going to be horrible, and it was actually well made and, you know, pretty good. But like since then, I think the only times you ever hear it spoken of are people talking about it pejoratively or me saying how amazing it is. So, you know, I think that's the one.
Yeah, it's like the funny thing is, I really like it as well. Like, that was a 4-star review for me, and I said, like, part of the thing was, I know what it's trying to do emotionally, and I went with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really trying to dupe us.
No.
And I don't know. I think maybe people aren't looking for that kind of story anymore. It's a very, very old school story. Like, it really feels like, I know it's not, but it really feels like it's a kind of like a book written in the early part of the last century.
Well, look, I mean, I, you know, recently I've been watching some John Ford movies. Like, I watched The Quiet Man, which is the big influence on Spielberg.
Right.
And, you know, that movie's considered a classic. And it's totally cheesy, and it's totally, you know, wears its heart on its sleeve. And I think, you know, War Horse plays on a bit of a grander scale, so I think some people might take offense to that, yeah, like, in terms of the subject matter. But it plays with the same kind of tone, and it, in my opinion, does it pretty remarkably. So.
I always also think that, it, in some ways, it comes back to how it was sold. Like, I think people saw those trailers and those posters and made their mind up early on. You know, it's kind of funny because I remember I knew what was coming, but I saw those ads. I was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
Right down to the font on the poster.
Oh,
I hated that font. Keeping in mind that this show is not that long, what's a film that everybody else likes that you do not?
Everybody loves Playtime. I do not like Playtime.
Really?
Yeah.
Playtime would have been like your thing.
Don't like Tati in general.
Okay.
Haven't really liked any of his movies too much. Here and there, like, I enjoy bits of Playtime.
Right.
I kind of admire its, like, amazing ambition, but it's, I find it very boring. Yes, I saw it in 70mm.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you got to see one of the screenings. Yeah, okay, well, okay, first of all, it's comedy, of course, right? So, comedy is subjective, so, you know, nobody should really be holding your feet to the fire for not
Yeah, but people
comedy.
Do.
They do?
People do.
They tell you you're a horrible human
talk
being.
Talk to Bob.
I try not to. Sorry, Bob, we love you. I can see that, because it holds a lot of its gags very long.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
And there's not really that many sequences to it. There's really only
too
like,
long, some would say.
Yeah.
And by some, I mean myself.
Yourself, yeah. Yes, I agree. You know what? Like, the funny thing is, I'm going to take that because I could have. There were about a dozen different movies I thought you were going to answer, and that was not the one I thought you were going to go with. I can totally see that. That's the kind of thing that if I showed it to anybody and said, hey, you might like this, and they said, you know.
I
wouldn't like crucify you for that. What was a recent film or the last film to make you cry?
Just earlier this week, it's the weekend, confused me. Last week I rewatched a Frank Borzage movie called Lucky Star, which
I have not heard of this.
It's Frank Borzage, silent film director, worked around the same time as Murnau.
Okay.
At Fox. Did a film called Seventh Heaven, which is like the first film to win Best Director at the Oscars, and that. So Lucky Star is Janet Gaynor and it's Charles Farrell.
Okay.
Melodrama romance involves, you know, a guy coming back from the war, crippled, and like girl falls in love with him, and there's a, you know, it's a really beautiful movie, really, really beautiful.
Okay. Was there any, without kind of giving away too much, was there any specific moment that kind of got you caught up?
Just the ending.
Oh, really?
And it's the second time I've seen, or third time actually, I've seen the movie, and first time I saw it, the ending almost put me off with how kind of big and melodramatic it was, but like now that I'm in that mode, it's just stunning.
Okay. I'll have to check that out. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for that. In the movie of your life, who plays you?
So for some reason, a lot of people will come up to me and say, you know who you look like? Spider-Man. And I don't understand. I don't understand it at all. They all mean Tobey Maguire, and I don't understand because I don't think I look like Tobey Maguire at all.
I sort of see it now that you pointed, but it's a reach.
I really don't think so. But I would like Tobey Maguire to play me, and then have a running gag throughout the movie of people telling him he looks like Spider-Man.
That would be good. And of course, like the thing that would be good about Tobey Maguire playing you is that you know you'd get some really good voiceover narration of your life, because it seems like most of Tobey Maguire movies, he does the voiceover work.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. I can see that. That's not bad. I like that one. And finally, what's the movie that you're gonna watch next?
I mean, I have no idea. Right now, I have a bunch of Frank Borzage silence loaded up on my computer, ready to go. But I'll probably end up watching some fluff like Mean Girls or something.
I'll watch what's on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. There's Corey. Thanks for that. We'll talk to you again in 30 episodes, I'm sure. In the meantime, though, it's time to talk to you fine folks. It's your chance to come talk to me right after this. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. So on episode 98, I asked, what was a film that people would like to change the ending to? And I'll throw the spoiler warning up right now. We are going to talk about The Women, Blade Runner, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, Heat, Pretty in Pink, Cold Mountain, Golden Compass, Casablanca, Harry Potter, and a few other titles. So if you really, really, really don't want to be spoiled, although I don't think you can be at this point, skip ahead now, but consider yourself warned. Catherine Stebbins, my guest on episode 98, where we talked about Escape from Tomorrow, said, I have to say The Women from 1939. That final shot of Norma Shearer holding out her arms and running to her off-screen husband has irked me all my life. If I had my way, her character wouldn't have gone back to him. But of course, the code never would have allowed that. The code wouldn't have allowed that?
The Hays Code. Why wouldn't production
it,
code.
Why wouldn't it have allowed that?
I'm trying to remember the exact plot of that movie. Basically, it needs to be a happy ending with the woman going back to the man.
Really?
You know, yeah, it's like...
It's terrible.
Yeah, you know how the code was.
Well, yeah, but that's... I thought the code was more about like how long you could kiss a person.
No, or... no. They had specific stuff about, you know, how characters had to redeem themselves and that kind of thing. Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah. Oh, no. So, okay, yeah. So that would... Well, yeah, that would totally make sense. Yeah, so Catherine, I think... even though I haven't seen The Women, I think I could probably agree with you knowing that. Jessica, our friend in Sweden from the Velvet Cafe, said, I have several to pick from. The classic example is Blade Runner. I don't hate the voiceover and forced happy end as much as some people do, but I still prefer the director's cut. A more recent film where I'd rather see a different ending is the final Harry Potter movie. That's going to come up a few times. I don't hate the scene as much. It's fine in the novel. And those young actors in terrible makeup just didn't look believable on the screen. The audience fell into laughter, which can hardly have been the intention. I could as well just left that to the imagination. Okay, so Blade Runner. Was the voiceover in all of them?
In all of what?
Well, I know. Okay, so
in
all
of the cuts,
yeah,
it's only in the theatrical cut.
Okay,
and I guess the international. I don't remember, but it's definitely the theatrical cut.
Okay, because I thought that the ending. Now, is the unicorn at the end of every film, or was that dropped in as well?
That I don't remember. It might have been dropped in, but certainly the narration at the end of voiceover in that movie is terrible in general, but
oh, yes.
Especially at the end.
Yeah, yeah. So, but that's the thing is that with like I think that unicorn I think is what colors the happy ending that she's talking about because if it's not there,
that's right. Yeah.
Then it leaves it far more. Actually, it doesn't even if it's not there, then it doesn't even imply what is implied.
Right. Right, exactly.
And that's the thing. With it there, and you're like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
You know, that's definitely the better ending. So if that's the ending that Jessica has seen, I could totally see that. Andrew James from the Row 3 Cinecast in Minneapolis says, I will go with Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
I agree.
What I didn't like about the ending is that it ended too soon. I wanted another hour of her story, and it certainly ends on somewhat of a harrowing cliffhanger. Yeah. A harrowing cliffhanger. I'm sorry. Italian Wedding, I swear. It ends with a question, which can be just fine in some films, but in Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, I just felt like her story wasn't over yet.
Well, you know what it was? It's that movie wasn't all that good. And
easy now.
And the ending is an extremely lazy way to add kind of import and mystery to a story that just was not going anywhere.
I loved that movie. I really, really liked that movie.
It's beautiful to look at.
Well, it's
a terrible ending.
I don't know, but it had like it was a really mysterious, and I liked it as a non clear ending of mm-hmm. what's to come and what's going to happen from here on out. We just know that she's getting out of the area. We don't know what's going to happen even just a mile down the road, right?
True.
So I don't know. I really really dug it. Now, granted, I could have spent another hour with those people.
Yeah. If you want a much better mysterious paranoid ending, Kelly Reichardt's recent film that played at TIFF.
Oh yeah.
Night Moves.
Does the same thing much, much stronger.
That's true. Yeah, that's coming next year. People, watch that movie.
Yeah.
Andrew, by the way, also goes on to say, also, I wish King Kong lived.
Defeats the whole purpose.
I know. On Facebook, Dan Heaton in St. Louis said, I can't say I'd change an ending since it likely would impact the rest of the film and change the intentions. That said, it does kill me every time when Robert De Niro's Neil McCauley in Heat decides to go back to the hotel. It totally fits his character, but he's doomed from that point because of that choice. I can see that, because the rest of the movie he's been so calculating,
mm-hmm.
right? He deliberately does not go on emotion, and that's the one time where he seems to be going on vengeance as an emotion too,
mm-hmm.
right? I love Heat. To the nth degree, but I could see that for sure. Mm-hmm. Alex Kittle in Massachusetts says, there are several films that make things all lovey-dovey at the end. Instead, I just want the main female characters to go off and do their own thing. Like Desperately Seeking Susan and Casual Sex. Actually, both had less romantic endings originally, but were changed for the final cuts, because I guess focusing on friendship is less satisfying to a lot of audiences. Mm-hmm. I know it's a book first, but when I was watching the latest version of Jane Eyre, I also remembered that I kind of don't want her to end up with Mr. Rochester. Spoilers for Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Which probably reveals the depths of my unsentimental soul. And finally, Pretty in Pink. Ah, goddamn, Andrew McCarthy, so gross. Ruins the movie, which is one of the reasons Some Kind of Wonderful is the best John Hughes movie ever.
Yep.
There's a lot to go through there. She's right.
Yeah, I think she's right as on a general point. It reminds me recently, on the recommendation of Callum Marsh, actually, I watched Nora Ephron's Bewitched.
Wow.
Yeah, which, for the first two-thirds, is a really good, interesting movie.
Okay.
About, like, a woman learning to just be, like, her own person. And then in the last third, it has to follow the regular romantic comedy thing. And it was really interesting. It's, you know, didn't get a lot of credit when it came out, but it's a much better movie than it was given credit for. Right. But the ending still.
It sort of reminds me, it's not going to come up, yeah. but it sort of reminds me of, do you remember how the ending of My Best Friend's Wedding was changed? Because, originally in testing, they had Julia Roberts get the guy.
Really?
That was the original script. Was Julia Roberts gets Dermot Mulroney away from Cameron Diaz
or Durbel McDillett?
Yeah, yes. And audiences hated that. They're like, she's a bitch. She just went in there and destroyed her friend's wedding, ruined this woman's life who she doesn't even know. So they had to play it differently because people didn't want the lovey-dovey ending. So yeah, Alex is right. These ones where something more complex could be brought about is probably the better way to go, and you kind of wish that, you know,
mm-hmm.
movies would do that more often. Donkey Wrangler to the Stars just said Boxing Helena.
Haven't seen it.
Me neither. I was hoping that you could explain it. So thanks, dude. Let me know what broaden that one out a little for me. That'd be great. Jess Rogers in New York said, there are a bunch of films that I might try to prevent all the death and sadness at the end, such as Cold Mountain and House of Sand and Fog. Yeah, those are the latter especially is a bummer. But it's the movies with sequel setups that never produce a sequel that piss me off, such as The Golden Compass. What was the movie? Ender's Game, I just watched, and I'm like, yeah, you're trying to set up a sequel, you're
all
not going to get.
All those, Prometheus.
But we're getting another Prometheus.
Maybe.
I don't think we're getting another Ender's Game.
True.
Emma Farley in England said that there are romances where I wanted people to get together who didn't. But I think the reason is that they have become classics is because how bittersweet they are, such as Casablanca and Roman Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
See, there we go. Yeah,
you perfect endings.
Right. Yeah. Nick Hazara in... I always get this wrong. She's in Dubai. There we go. I've been saying Mumbai lately. I don't know why.
Different city.
Different country. Am I too late for this? My pick would be Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. I despise the epilogue from the bottom of my heart. Somehow, the coolest kids who ever saved the wizarding world turn into the most boring adults who have ever lived. What? Just wish they'd have put more life into it. Given Ron a few lines, maybe? Or just scrap the whole thing? Now, when she puts it that way, There's one reason why I actually do like that ending.
It's because that's the point. They just grow into boring adults.
Exactly. You know, like there are there are tons of star quarterbacks out there who are running car dealerships.
Yeah. The real problem in that is just the makeup isn't the greatest. But I'll be honest, when
they would have been better casting adults who look like the kids.
That I don't know because they're so recognizable. But you know, when I saw it in the theater at midnight, you know, just that. People were laughing hysterically during that scene, which kind of ruined it. When I saw it later on my own, it played okay. Like, it really wasn't so bad. It's not... There's no winning with that scene, but, like, I think it's still a nice sentiment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Bubba Wheat from Flights, Tights, and Movie Nights... Oh, this is going to piss you off. Said, no question, AI should have ended with the Blue Fairy.
That's a longer discussion.
That's a whole other show.
That we have time. That we have time for. A lot of people believe that, but yeah, it's yep.
I always thought that it should have ended when he pitches himself off the building. Like, go really dark. Screw this. I can't find her. Gone.
Yeah, I don't
know.
About
roll
that.
Credits.
I don't know about that.
Daniel McCarthy, also in England, said Shawshank Redemption. Oh, this is good. What? Wait. No, actually, he's got a really good point. And like, that's the thing. When I first saw it, I was like, what? Shawshank Redemption. Zihuatanejo's mythic beauty speaks volumes. I don't need to see it. It should have ended with Red on the Bus.
Yeah, but I hope.
I know. Well, you can still have that. I guess.
But the image is so beautiful. I love, when I think of Shawshank, one of the things I think about is that final shot.
Yeah. So. No, I agree with you. James Blake Ewing said, I'd change the ending of Return of the Jedi back. Why? Because it doesn't make sense now. Why is Obi-Wan old and why is Anakin young?
Well, I think the real answer is to take Ewan McGregor and put him into episode 6. Why haven't they made that change?
Well, because you're replacing Alec Guinness.
Yeah, but they replaced...
some old dude.
No, shoot, what was his name? I forget it. Anyway...
Yeah, you need to make them, like, whatever you do, you need to make them match.
I'm just saying that I'm appealing to George Lucas. Obviously, he would much sooner change more things.
Oh, I see. So. You're playing the odds. I like that. Okay. Jandy Stone also said AI, artificial intelligence, just cut off 2 or 3 endings, and it'd be fine. She also said something else that I'll get back to later. And finally, Rachel Thoreau said, as much as I dig Sunshine, I think we can all pretty much agree that the last act didn't need to turn into some sort of slasher story. Also, I would cut the epilogue to Harry Potter, fine to read but painful to watch. I'd accept it as a post-credit scene that I can skip.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, so JD said something that I'll get back to with my answer. What's an ending that you change?
The worst kind of thing is that Prometheus syndrome where it's like setting up sequels. That I really can't stand. And there's no reason to ever do it, in my opinion. There's ways to leave a story open to more without having to like put chess pieces in place.
Okay.
And a lot of movies are doing that recently, and it makes the endings of those movies just awful.
It makes it kind of false?
Yeah.
Jandy actually did tip off my answer. And she mentioned Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. I like the content of the ending, but the pacing forced way too many emotional climaxes. And that series of endings, that collection of endings,
it's true,
actually put me off the whole series. Like I
Well, I don't know about that.
Well,
but it did. But
because here's the thing. I don't go back and revisit them for like how big they are and for how much I enjoyed 1 and 2 at the time and most of 3 at the time. I don't reach for them ever. Ever.
I still do, but I reach for them individually. Like, I tend not to watch them in marathons, so I'll watch the first one just because I enjoy watching it. Or I'll watch, like, Disc 2 of the Two Towers because that's Helm's Deep.
Right. You know? Yeah. But, you know, Return of the King, it had at least, like, off the top of my head, it had at least 3 points where it could have ended and just, and like, gone to black and it would have been the end of the story. But then there's another scene. And then there's another scene. And they even cut it before there was another scene because, you know, there's something else.
Peter Jackson's worst tendencies. That
ending is... But it goes into hyperdrive there. The other ones stop where they're supposed to stop.
Have you seen The Hobbit?
Yeah.
That is a perfect encapsulation
of everything
Jackson...
Well, The Hobbit has its own set of problems.
Well, it does, but it's the same kind of thing of, like, let's just make it longer because we want to luxuriate in, like, this world that we've built and created, and we don't want to leave it. And that's the problem with the ending of Return of the King. Like, I think the it's emotionally honest, but it just... It doesn't realize that it could end earlier.
Of course.
We'd get the same ideas.
Of course.
You know...
Yeah, no. So that's always been my answer. And as I said, like for me, it threw me off so much that I never went back to it. There's a copy at our apartment. I never watch it again. Well, no feedback question for episode 100. We're gonna have way too much to do, but watch the Twitter feed and the Facebook feed for the matinee, and there will be a question for episode 101 in a few weeks. From here, though, we're gonna go to the new slang, and I'm gonna throw up a spoiler warning because I really feel like Broken Circle Breakdown needs to be talked about as a complete piece. There is an emotional beat that's kind of central to the story, and while it happens early on, some people could consider it a spoiler. So consider yourself warned, but please do come back because we got a really cool movie to talk about, Broken Circle Breakdown, right after this.
He went downtown to his neighbor's door.
Broken Circle Breakdown is directed by Felix van Groeningen. It's written by him along with Carl Juice, adapted by a play by Johan Heldenberg and Mika Dobels. That's a lot of Flemish right there.
Yep.
It stars Virla Battens, Johan Heldenberg, and Neil Catrice. Nell Catrice, thank you. It is about the relationship of Didier and Elise. That's the first two stars I talked about. Didier is a guitar player, Elise is a tattoo artist, and it's about what happens to them after they get married and have a young daughter named Maybelle. Through the course of the film, we discover that Maybelle, at the age of, I'm going to say seven, she would have been?
Eight? Six or seven.
Six or seven. She's diagnosed with cancer, and she has a fight on her hands, and of course, that already in itself taxes the parents. And early on, Maybelle actually passes away, and that throws the parents for an even bigger loop as far as how they grieve. So when I thought back on Broken Circle Breakdown, we actually saw it together, which it's one of the, on your birthday, no less.
Yeah.
It's one of the few times in the history of the show, I think I can count the times I've watched the feature review with the person next to me on like one hand. And it only happens like every 40 or 50 episodes. But when we watched it, we watched a story that seems to have Middle America written all over it. And Middle America is filled with great stories. They're stories that come from working class people, living ordinary lives. But when we turn our attention towards them, we find that ordinary lives can come with a lot of high drama in its own right. So, pop quiz, hotshot, is Broken Circle Breakdown the most American movie that comes from somewhere other than America?
That comes from someone other than America? That's too big a question. I'm sure there are others. But yeah, this movie is on the one hand quite in love with America and American style storytelling, and obviously American music
and American culture.
Yeah, old time folk music and bluegrass, and so it has all that, but it does kind of it does have its points of kind of critique, mm-hmm. which are sort of interesting, especially in terms of how they relate to the character's perception of the United States,
right.
without actually, you know, living there.
Right. So I actually don't know, because when the movie ended, we didn't really talk about it. What did you think of Broken Circle Breakdown?
Oh, I thought it was great.
Okay.
Yeah. I thought it was excellent.
And like anything in particular that like jumped out at you that you really like latched onto early on?
I mean, so I'm gonna set this up by reading the plot description on Wikipedia, because this is literally all I knew about the movie going in.
Okay.
Okay. So the plot description on Wikipedia is: the film explores the lives of Didier and Elisa over 7 years as they fall in love through their passion for bluegrass music and eventually have a daughter who will change their lives forever.
That's not the movie we saw.
Well, I mean, technically,
yeah, well,
it is.
Yeah.
But I went in kind of expecting this, you know, wonderful romance with bluegrass music, and you'll see based on the movies that we're going to talk about later, it's kind of like I thought it was going to be a very different kind of movie. Ended up being this, you know, very emotional film that, you know, it could have played in the realm of melodrama, and actually it probably might have worked even as that.
Yeah.
But instead, the film kind of explores these characters as they're dealing with their daughter's illness, their daughter's death, the grieving process, and it keeps flashing back between those scenes kind of in the present and scenes in the past of them falling in love and starting their relationship and having the daughter. And in a way, it actually reminded me of, like, Blue Valentine in the way that it kind of structurally flashes back. But to me, this one was a lot, in a way, a lot more honest, because it dealt with a specific situation and dealt with this couple kind of struggling to hold on to itself, mm-hmm. you know, this relationship. And you can feel the emotions are there, but there's just... there's too much going on for this couple to really connect as they should be. And it always feels realistic, even in kind of the more lovey-dovey heightened moments. It feels like they're real characters, and I really responded to it.
See, for me, and I really enjoyed it, as much as one can enjoy a movie like this as well. For me, what I really latched to was... actually the opposite. I latch to their scenes of pain and mm-hmm. their expressions of tension and frustration and division, because I find that can often be overplayed. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we talked about melodrama, and there's a fine line between good melodrama and the kind of melodrama that puts people off.
Right.
And I find that this film is very, very much on the right side of that line. You compare it to Blue Valentine, one of the films that I started thinking of was Rabbit Hole, actually, because that's got a very similar...
I haven't seen Rabbit Hole.
It's got a very similar story where a child is lost mm-hmm. and you have to deal with two people picking up the pieces, because the fact is that two people always can't and often don't.
Yeah.
But what I liked about this in comparison to Blue Valentine, and it was actually going to be my next point, is that structure of... jumping back and forth in time to the beginnings of their relationship and their roles as parents, to both the situation that they have to go through with Maybelle getting sick, and then after she dies, especially, because that was the thing, I didn't know, this sounds terrible to say, they kill her very quickly.
Well, I think it's about halfway through the movie, but yeah, it's like, a 2-hour movie.
Yeah, it's a 2-hour movie, but when she's gone that quick, like you're like, whoa, holy crap, like I thought that was going to drag out a little longer.
Right, the movie then becomes about something else. It becomes about their relationship.
Right. I really I liked that. It basically, it gives the film this kind of, this third level, because you have like the before and the after, and you also see the during, which you don't all, you certainly didn't see it in Rabbit Hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that structure, it really, really gave you a sense of how these people were seeing each other change, right? Like, there is a physical change that goes on with Eliza anyway, because mm-hmm. when she's in the early going, she's a firecracker, right? She's this tattooed, you know, rock chick, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And you can just, like, she's the kind of girl that just would have the attention of every single guy in the room,
mm-hmm.
right? Just in the way that she presents herself and, you know, the kind of things that she's into. And then as Maybelle gets sick, and certainly after Maybelle dies, you sort of see the life drain out of her through no real trick, except for the fact that her hair is a little bit messier.
Yeah.
And she's a little bit more...
it's really in the performance.
Yeah. And that was for me what made this a lot more interesting.
It's an interesting film, and also we haven't really touched on the music.
That was going to be my next point, but...
which is, you know, the movie is basically a musical.
Yes.
With the amount of like full on songs that it has. And, you know, when we're talking about what kind of the film avoiding melodrama, it uses the music in a way to get away with those kind of high emotions.
Yeah.
Where it's like it gives you that space that a melodrama might have given you.
Right.
So that you have those moments, especially during the girl's funeral.
Oh, my God.
And the song Go to Sleep, You Little Baby plays... which completely recontextualizes it after knowing it from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's this moment, like, you can't help but tear up. And in a way, you know, you could say it's manipulative or whichever, but it feels honest to the characters, and it feels honest to just the structure of the movie, because it is musical, right?
Yeah. And these are people, like... You can tell DDA's band especially, and Eliza to a certain extent as well, they live and breathe music. Music is their religion. It's their whole reason for being. So to believe that they would sing and or play at a funeral, at a wedding, at a birth, at a death, you totally, totally believe it is what they would do.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
You know, they are, we get back to that theme of America, they are a New Orleans funeral band, if ever there was one. And you're right. A lesser film would have had the characters break out into song to express what they're feeling.
Right.
But by cutting away to these performances,
yeah,
where the lyrics and the melody match what's happening,
yeah,
both for better and for worse. Oh my! Like I was just like over the moon when that would happen.
In a way, it steals a trick from one of my favorite movies, which we've discussed, is Cabaret.
Yeah.
Where, you know, in this the songs are a bit more interwoven into the actual.
Oh, why didn't I think of that? Son of a bitch.
But it does a similar thing of, like, you know, you have these scenes fraught with emotion, and then it gives you an emotional release through a song that basically comments on
what's happening.
Yeah. And, you know, and it does it as subtly as it could possibly do such a thing, and the music helps. That the music is so beautiful.
The music's amazing. Yeah. I don't know about you, but like that night I got home, I got my hands on the soundtrack, and I spent Friday just listening to it on a loop.
Yeah, excellent soundtrack.
Yeah.
I love bluegrass, so that, you know.
Yeah, for the love of God, even if you don't see this movie, like, you know, get your headphones out and check out the soundtrack, because you will listen to some really, really good songs. The other thing that I liked about this movie, so, you know, we have a really, really... iconic character in Eliza, in the way that she's got all those tattoos.
Yeah.
You know, like she's
visually iconic.
Visually
yeah.
iconic. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I don't mean iconic like capital I.
Yeah.
Iconic,
yeah, yeah.
Like, visually. But I like the whole idea when she was talking about that if something goes wrong and you don't like one of them that you've done, that they're not actually that permanent, that you can just, you know, tattoo over them and away you go. And then of course we see her try to do that with her life. We see her try to paint, like she literally paints over a room and takes what's out, what's in there from out. Mm-hmm. Some might see it as a forced metaphor. The idea of but I, for me, it worked that you can, you know, yeah, sure. If you've got somebody's name tattooed on your arm, you can fill in the banner with black and then, you know, that name was never there. But that, you know, even though we talk about tattoos as something that's permanent, that they could be manipulated in ways that other things actually can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an over the top point, like, you know.
I don't even think
it's mirrored. Like, it's not one of those scenes where something bad happens and something good happens.
It's never directly mirrored. It's just a general theme of, you know, in terms of the grieving process, people trying to, like you said, kind of ink over parts of their lives. And in some ways, where the film is smart is that. It doesn't overplay that, and it's interesting to note the things that she tries to ink over, and the things that in fact, in some cases, she didn't choose to ink over. You know, her husband, let's say, convinced her to.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so there's kind of a nuance in how that general theme is employed throughout the film, and it's extremely effective. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah. Now, with all that said, for me, there was a flaw. And for me, the flaw was DDA's breakdown on stage. I've had to wrestle with it because I know why he broke down. And we'll talk about it again, actually, because that's going to come up in one of our two other side films of an on-stage breakdown. But I felt like the idea... So he's upset that America at the time is fighting stem cell research, and that was specifically what was leading Maybelle to have any chance of recovery and remission from her cancer. So we first see it when he sees a TV screen where George W. Bush is talking about how he did an executive veto on stem cell research. And you know, that sets him off of why, you know, why is America like this? Why don't they, why aren't they doing that? And then not long after that, he has a similar conversation with seemingly nobody on stage, like right after a song, and just really, really goes off the rails about God, about America, about morality, and it goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And like, it makes us feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. For me, I was already uncomfortable. Like, he got me with his first few words. Yeah. And I think the reason why I see that scene as a flaw, especially, is because it comes after, for me, the climax of the film. Like, the song that they play right before that, right. I was damn near in tears. And I could feel myself, like, lifting out of myself, saying, "I this movie has me so completely." And then he just went off.
See, here's where I'll disagree with you.
Okay.
I think that it's all one... There's a couple climaxes that happen. There's that, there's a couple scenes later on in the film too, because there's still a bit more after that sequence.
There's her death. Her death is a climax of sorts.
It is, yeah. And the sequence that you're talking about, I think, it works as a full sequence. So you get this song where, you know, this is the moment where in a lesser movie, let's say, they would suddenly hold hands again and get back. It would be like, we'll talk about it later, but the scene at the end of A Mighty Wind.
Yeah.
You know, it would be that. That's what it would be. And they, you know, they would console each other, and you'd get this idea, oh, maybe things are going to be a bit better, blah, blah, blah. But she doesn't go for that when he reaches out.
Right.
And that's what sets him off. And part of the beauty of it is that he keeps going and going. When he's ranting, he just keeps ranting and ranting. And it becomes progressively uncomfortable. And I think the most uncomfortable moment is actually when, again, there's a moment where you think, oh, maybe this is going to end a bit better than we think, where she tries to stop him. And you think, oh, wow, maybe she's going to actually console him or something. And he just pushes her away.
Yeah.
And she walks off the stage, and he keeps ranting until he can't rant anymore. And I think that there's an honesty there in terms of how people miss those points of connection with each other.
Yeah.
And that just sends people off the rails into their own little... you know, spirals.
Okay. You're saying...
And you're right that like, on an editing level, maybe they could have cut it down slightly, but I did appreciate that it went long with it. It let it be as uncomfortable as possible, because that's what it's supposed to be, you know?
Yeah. You raise a good point in that, you know, sometimes you're so angry. Like, you're pissed at the world. And somebody reaches out to try and, like, tell you that it's okay, but, you know, you don't recognize it because you just want to be pissed. Right, and that's ultimately just that much more damaging. Yeah. So,
and that's the cycle that this couple is caught in for like a good section of the movie, where they love each other so much, but never at the same time.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
like they just keep missing it,
yeah.
and that keeps perpetuating this cycle of anger and and grief. Yeah.
Well, I want to end the review on the spot we came in, which is the myth of America, because we even like. Again, I said it before, America is all over this movie, right down to the bikini that Eliza's wearing
quite
when she's
bikini.
It's quite the bikini that she's wearing on the hood of DDA's car. But that I actually, this is kind of different for me because I'm talking about this movie before I've written about it, and the one thing that I did write in what I've written already is that America is more than just a country. America is an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And like an idea that may not actually be realized right now within the country itself, or an idea that may never have existed for all we know, but to people like this, it's something that kind of guides them. Like it's certainly in the music that they embody.
Well, there's the music, there's the sense,
the lifestyle, even like he's living a very American life.
He is, and there's the sense that, you know, he lives this lifestyle kind of. I don't know if he actually wants to go live in the States, but it feels like there's...
Certainly not by the time the movie's over.
Well, certainly not, but there's this kind of specter hanging over him of America will always be there if I need to go there.
Yeah.
If I need a second chance, it'll be there.
Yeah, if I need the place of opportunity, that's the place where a person who has nothing can go and be something.
You know, and when they have a child and they name her Maybelle, which is a totally American name, and you get the feeling, okay, now they're putting that future into their daughter, and then they lose the daughter. And I think sort of the way that the film deals with the death of that ideal, the death of that future, and I almost expected at a certain point, like, oh, maybe the way they'll try and repair their relationship is to have that second chance in the United States. But the beauty of it is that the United States remains that ideal that they can't really go for. It's because it wouldn't fix anything realistically.
No. And that's the thing. And like maybe that's like that why I say the myth of America is I think sometimes, and I'm going to tread very lightly here, I think sometimes Americans think that America is something different than it actually is. It is too ambitious an idea that prosperity and opportunity can be there for all at the cost of none.
Maybe, but I think that the idea or the ideal, let's say.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
In terms of having one, is important. And I think that's.
Oh sure.
And that's what Didier recognizes in. America, quote unquote, and it's like the last shot of the film, basically reaffirms that.
Yeah,
I'm not going to give anything away, but it
does.
It really does. It's saying, hold on to that ideal.
Yeah. Well, we end our reviews on a souvenir. So, Corey Tad, if there is one thing that you could take away and keep from Broken Circle Breakdown, what would be your souvenir?
Oh, like the soundtrack that I downloaded and will listen to.
Exactly.
Literally.
For me, it's similar on that, and I love movies like this where I actually have a tangible souvenir. It's specifically the song and the scene of If I Needed You. The last time I felt like this about a song in the context of a film was Falling Slowly in Once. I find that films, the songs that perfectly express something so complicated and so real, mm-hmm. and bring it into such a tangible song, they're so rare, and that's, I think, because I was bordering on tears. I swear to God, if you weren't sitting next to me, I would have been a blubbering mess when that
same here,
okay,
buddy,
there
same
we
here.
Go when that song came up. So that was why when DDA went off right afterwards, I was like, just let me have that, just let me stay in that moment just a little longer.
Yep.
We rate films on the Matinee Cast on a scale of 1 to 4. Corey Attad, what do you give Broken Circle Breakdown?
Let's say a 3.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I came away from it, I was actually thinking that it was a 3.5 movie, but it has stuck with me so hard through this weekend that I even with the flaw, that's a 4-star movie. Like, it affected me so much and it stuck with me.
It really depends on your definitions, and I just said 3.5 so that I'm not. Nobody's gonna be like, "Hey, perfect movie."
No. And that's the thing. That's like that. I had that conversation earlier this year that something can get a perfect score and not be a perfect movie. But and ordinarily for me, I've said that last half star usually comes down to emotional lift. And this, and Lord knows, this movie had that emotional lift for me.
Yeah, it's really niggling over that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
just see the movie. It's excellent.
Please, God, Lord, please see this movie. Track it down, source it out. It is fantastic. Broken Circle Breakdown. Let us know what you think. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook, all that jazz. I would love to know what people think of Broken Circle Breakdown. We're going to come right back after this and talk about two movies that we chose before we saw Broken Circle Breakdown. Come on back. We'll flip the record over and play the other side. So Corey's choice, mercifully, to lighten up the mood after Broken Circle Breakdown, was from 2003. It's a Christopher Guest film called A Mighty Wind, and it is a mockumentary, if you like that word, about some folk acts from the 60s that all reconnect after the head of the folk label passes away, and they put on a great big show. So, do you remember how you first came to A Mighty Wind? Did you see it in theaters? Were you like already aware of Christopher Guest?
I had seen Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
When I was younger, so that was always kind of that existed. But then in the Christopher Guest ones, I forget who. Somebody recommended Waiting for Guffman. When I saw that, then I was like, okay, now I have to track down all of these things.
I was lucky, actually. My coworkers were big fans of Best in Show, so they would always like be lobbing quotes around all day, and I was like, so I that was how I got into and watched Best in Show, and then not long after that whole thing happened was when A Mighty Wind came out, And that's For Your Consideration are the only two Christopher Guest films I ever saw in theaters. The thing I really dig about A Mighty Wind is actually encapsulated with a line by John Michael Higgins, because there's a great joke where he says, "I suffered a lot of abuse as a child, mostly musical in nature." He says that his parents would lock him in a room with
that's my favorite
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, well, because I don't know about you, but I joke about that, right? Yeah. Like my parents, they did it right in the end of things, because they actually raised me on a lot of country and a lot of oldies. So while my friends were listening to like pop music and rap music and that kind of thing, I was being force fed Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash and Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
And like as a kid, it's like, why am I listening to this again? So I always love that. Did you rewatch it for? Did you come across with anything?
I mean, like, I enjoyed it all over again. It's not the funniest Christopher Guest movie, because so much is about like hearing the music.
Yeah.
And the songs themselves, like some of them are a bit funny. Like even the more serious ones are actually a little bit like they have these like weird lines in them that are pretty funny. But for the most part, the music is done sincerely.
Yeah.
So it plays like in a way as kind of a nice concert movie with good music, mm-hmm. or mostly good music. And, you know, whereas like something like Best in Show gets to have, you know, the commentators and stuff during the dog shows.
Right.
This doesn't have that, so it's less like
you kind of get that in characters like Bob Balaban and
Bob Balaban's hilarious.
He's fantastic.
The bit where he doesn't understand
3D sets.
Yes. It's like, he doesn't understand the concept of perspective.
Yeah, this is which flat. Is Why is it flat?
Incredible.
I had Ed Begley Jr.
Yes,
as well. You know, like when he's standing in the control room, going, "What's that thing? It's like a crane, like a crane." Yeah, can you have one? No. And just the thing I always love about Christopher Guest movies is the way they're peppered with randomness.
Yeah.
So, for instance, speaking of Balaban and Ed Begley Jr., when Ed Begley Jr. tells the story of the label head giving him a ticket to the concert that was sold out, and he just drops Yiddish term after Yiddish yes. term after Yiddish in the middle for no friggin' reason, you know. Cause
it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, this great big Swede all of a sudden is, yeah. you know.
I also love little bits like, you know, when they're having the meeting about putting the show on, like, what's the network called, PBN or something?
Yeah.
It's like PBS,
yeah.
Fictional PBS, and the head of the network says, unfortunately, our audience over the years has tended to skew older, but lucky for you. And I'm just like, little bits like that just make me laugh so much.
Oh man. I
love the way that the film creates this world in which apparently, this old time folk music, cause it's not folk music, not like rock folk music,
no.
like
it's not
Bob
like
Dylan. It's like old time bluegrass style folk
yeah.
music. And it implies that through the 60s, this was, like, the biggest music. There's this, like, subtle implication through the movie that, like...
That's not completely untrue.
It's...
We're going to see that again with Inside Llewyn David.
The like, specific I mean, type of music that's
it's
in
sort
this...
sort of what? Like, Peter Paul and Mary was huge.
Peter Paul and Mary
and
was
Joan
huge.
Baez
it's true, but
like,
Peter Paul and Mary isn't quite the kind of music that's in this. It's this really insular kind of world.
Yeah. Well, apparently,
of music,
apparently
but it's implied that it's much bigger than it was.
Well, actually,
the thing I was going to say was that I love that the movie kind of recognizes that, and that it has the audience watching the music playing out, and most of the audience is like they're kind of enjoying it, but there's the one woman at the front of the audience who's super into the songs.
Oh, like, I never noticed her.
No, because it's like clearly the rest of the audience, like the songs are written for the movie, they clearly don't know the music, but they have one woman at the front who's memorized all the songs and is singing along and is like way too into the music.
What I did notice is Balaban's brother, he's actually a Canadian actor, and I can never remember his name. I think he was on the Beachcombers. he says early on about how dad was a folk label executive, and I never got it. I never got folk music. And you could see even through the whole concert, he's so bored.
Yeah.
He's sitting, and he's, same thing, he's sitting front and center, and he's so bored.
Yep.
And I love that they threw that in too, that he's like, yeah, I know we're doing this for dad, but I still don't get it.
Nope.
The other cool thing I love about this movie, and this actually is where it marries up to Broken Circle Breakdown very, very nicely. I love films where great songs are still commissioned.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like they're kind of rare. The movies like Once and Mighty Wind and that kind of thing, where music is so central, you know, that they play. Because a lot of time the music that they play in it can be kind of forgettable.
Yeah.
It's a really important piece. And I actually think that that's where this movie really, really flourishes, given that you've got, you know, guys like Christopher Guest and Michael McKean writing music. Apparently, McKean wrote a lot of the songs while driving.
Yeah.
The story was that he and his wife, he's married to Annette O'Toole.
Annette O'Toole,
yeah.
Who has writing credits on some of the songs, which is amazing.
That apparently they were trying to fly from the East Coast to Vancouver because she was going to be filming in Vancouver. And when 9/11 happened, their flights got grounded. So they're like, well, screw it, we got to drive. And while they were driving, they came up with a whole bunch of songs.
Yeah.
I love A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow. It's a pretty beautiful song.
It is a good
song.
And then there's stuff like Potatoes in the Paddy Wagon,
which
is just
ridiculous.
Ridiculous and amazing.
Can I ask you a question? What accent is Jennifer Coolidge doing in this movie?
I don't know, but it's incredible whatever it is. It's one of those things where, like, it would be racist. There's two things. First of all, it would either be racist or, like, you know, get into trouble for making fun of, like, disabled people, like mentally handicapped people, except that it's never clear what she's doing.
No.
So it avoids that. It just becomes hilarious. It's amazing.
Oh, man. And word is that she didn't tell anyone she was going to do it. Like, that
how were they not dying on the set?
I don't know. I kind of miss Christopher Guest. I know, like, he just did Family Tree on HBO.
Wasn't that.
Did I not?
Yeah.
I'm not missing anything?
It's not that good.
Okay. See, I don't really necessarily want him to keep doing mockumentaries, but I want more films from the man.
Yeah.
You know, that was the
one. What was his last one for your consideration?
This is his last feature, yeah.
Oof, that's a long time ago.
It is. It's like, you know, it's like 6 years ago now. Yeah. And again, like, it can be a straight up comedy. He could do a drama for all I care.
I'd like to see more, yeah.
Yeah. Oh man, I adore this movie. And after the heaviness of Broken Circle Breakdown, I actually really needed a lift, so I do thank you for that. I actually kind of want to take a second and point out your original choice for The Other Side was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it kind of plays on some of the same themes. But the thing that I thought was masterful, and we didn't even know this when you chose it, was that there's a song. The Ain't Nobody But the Babe is used in both films and in completely different, just extremely polar opposite different contexts. So when we saw that, I think we were both grinning when that song came up, which is weird to be grinning.
It was like grinning with like tears.
Yeah.
You know?
So, is there an ultimate takeaway from A Mighty Wind? Why, like, somebody should see it if they've never seen it before?
No, I mean, it's like, should be self-evident. Christopher Guest movie, mockumentary, if you like Spinal Tap or Best in Show or that kind of thing. I'm sure you've already seen A Mighty Wind, but if you haven't.
I was lucky enough, I got to do a podcast with the women from Across the Universe, and we were talking about music movies, and I got a great feeling from it because I got to recommend The Commitments, which they never seen. Like, I was like, you guys have seen The Commitments? And they're like, no. I was like, oh, I can't wait for you guys to see the, and Café de Flore as well, I got to recommend, and they hadn't seen that either. So, hey, for all I know, people haven't seen A Mighty Wind.
Look,
and
I'm sure there are.
I'm
not going to oversell it. It's not, like, as good as Spinal Tap or anything.
It's really good.
But it is very good, yeah.
Well, come on back after this. We'll talk about one more film on the other side and close out the show right after this break.
Come on, let's sing. It don't worry me. It don't worry me. You may say I ain't free. It don't worry me.
So for my choice for The Other Side, again, chosen without seeing Broken Circle Breakdown first, and I usually don't run it that way, but this time we kind of had to. I went with Nashville by Robert Altman from 1975, and it's this sprawling yet surprisingly self-contained portrait of Nashville in the 1970s and the entire country music scene that was happening there. Now, you hadn't seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think?
I thought it was great. Actually, I'd like to watch it again. It's an interesting film in that, and I kind of said something to this effect on Twitter, where it's like I was never quite sure what the film's perspective on Nashville or like Tennessee or the South in general was.
Okay.
And it there were points where it almost played like it could have been patronizing.
Yeah.
But it really never goes there, and it treats the characters like generally like real human beings, except for the British reporter.
Yes.
It treats everybody like, you know, a real human being, and it gets at aspects of American life that, you know, if we're talking about Broken Circle Breakdown in terms of its idealization of, you know, the United States, it kind of breaks that down in a way without ever losing it. It does a similar thing at the end, you know, where it kind of, it holds on to the ideal a little bit, even in the face of just really awful, you know, awful things. And it, you know, the film was obviously made in the specter of Watergate, and it was filmed, I think, during, like, Nixon resigned.
More or less,
while
yeah.
they were shooting the movie.
Yep.
So it, you know, it has all that hanging over it, and the film is certainly cynical, but it never gets too cynical. It always kind of, it pushes it and then steps back a little bit
yeah.
to get a broader picture. It's a great film.
Yeah, and I was definitely glad you liked it. I watched it for the second time, and I'm actually, like you, I'm looking forward to watching it again, because there's a Criterion Blu-ray of this coming in just a few weeks. I guess you're buying it now. If you weren't before.
Yeah, I would like to, yeah.
Okay.
There's too many. There's too many Criterions.
I know. So what I like is that, you know, we talked about the idea of America, and that Nashville, like America at the time, not even sort of now, that Nashville is a place of opportunity. My first experience with Nashville was actually at the Lightbox. They brought it through as part of their 100 film series when they first opened.
Yeah, yeah.
And the one thing I'll never forget that's probably like the best way that it was summed up is that before American Idol, there was Nashville. That country music, and Nashville in particular as a city and as a you know, place of musical embodiment, was where any old person could take their guitar case and step on stage at like the Bluebird Cafe
mm-hmm.
and be discovered and possibly become a star,
mm-hmm.
right? And there you see that certainly peppered through the story. There's two different people actually who are trying to do exactly that, who are trying to be discovered, and that's, again, that's the dream of America, that all it takes is just the right
yeah.
circumstances and some hard work, and that you can have it all. Even though that, you know, Nashville, again, it's and they even kind of fly that flag at one point, that it's its own ecosystem. It's not part of
right.
the greater, you know, possibly terrible things that happen elsewhere in America, but it's America at its best.
Yeah, it's sort of, well, yeah, best and worst. It's kind of a microcosm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So the other cool thing was, again, so I mentioned, you know, I suffered abuse as a child, mostly musical in nature. I listened to a lot of country growing up. I listened to a lot of Alabama.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, now I'm not so sorry, actually. You know, like, I was sorry for a long time. But, you know, Alabama, Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton, Johnny Cash. Not the best of any of them, really. Like, just what was on at the time. Later on, Garth Brooks. But I like that there are... The one thing I kind of dig about country music, and that you see in this movie, is that there's various facets
mm-hmm.
of it. There's the kind of... there's the... you know, very stately Haven Hamilton, you know, who his songs are very, very earnest.
Yep.
My God, are they earnest. And that's his kind of his whole persona, which was really different seeing what's his name like that.
Henry Gibson.
Yeah. Cause I was used to him more as, you know, the kind of,
well, were you used to him more from Magnolia?
Magnolia, or, and but also just from Laugh-In, where he's, you know, right. he's much more mousy. So it seems like so grand in that kind of way.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he even, you know, when he gives flowers, like he gives a bouquet of flowers to Barbara Jean.
Yeah.
I just love saying Barbara Jean like that. And they're in the shape of his initials.
Yeah.
Right? So there's, you know, there's that kind of country music. And then there's like Bill, Mary, and Tom kind of country music. And even when Tom does his own stuff, like there's all these different types all within this same umbrella. I really, that's the one thing I actually kind of dig that this movie shows and that the genre has. I don't get the impression that you listen to a whole lot of it.
Country music, generally, I don't really care for. I mean, I appreciate more the old time like folk music, so that's why I
like Hank Williams and
Hank Williams. Like the thing, that's why I like bluegrass,
right?
Because it is that acoustic, old time folk music. Generally, more like later developed country music, I'm not as into.
Was this painful? As
it always feels a bit more shallow. No, I mean, like the thing is, one of the things that I find with watching movies is that I tend to accept the music as part of the like world of the film.
Okay.
So like I tend not, it doesn't bother me. Let's put it this way. I wouldn't listen to a lot of that music on my own time.
And neither would I.
But in the movie, I have no problem with it.
So you're saying actually, and it's a good thing, is that a good movie like this should be about, like, should be able to appeal to people who aren't necessarily into what it's about.
Right,
so which is not, what I've always said. Right, like, you make a documentary about a band, it should be able to play to people beyond just fans of the band.
Well, that's true. Although documentaries about bands are a bit of a different game, I think this movie, you know, this movie is about country music,
right?
But it's not really about country music.
Okay,
like that's clearly not where the interest of the movie is. The interests of the movie are more in the political realities of America at the time, the social realities, especially with regards to women. It touches on race a little bit, kind of on the periphery, but not as in depth as it goes with the female characters. It gets into the corporatist kind of capitalist nature of success in America. And
how?
What do you mean?
What, like when?
Just in terms of what you were talking about, and people trying to be successful, and then it gets, you know, the scenes at the Grand Ole Opry where you have sponsorships for everything and that kind of stuff. It, you get this whole kind of full sense of how the society operates.
Okay.
And it works as a stand-in for the rest of the United States, but by focusing in on this one scene, you get all these different facets of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's what the concern of the film is. It's, you know, the music is almost secondary, and it's
very much secondary, actually.
Well, I mean, there's I think over an hour of music in it, so there is a lot of music, but it,
and full songs too. Like, we don't cut away very often.
No, it uses the music, rarely even just to comment. It's more just to create that world, kind of create your understanding of these people.
It fills in characters, both like who's on stage singing and who's out in the crowd.
Right, who's out in the crowd.
That is the cool thing I like about this movie, is this like Greek chorus worth of characters all seem to travel in a herd.
Yeah.
So even when like they're always at they're at the racetrack together, or they're at the picnic together, or they're at this show, or they're at this show. There's always like at least like 10 of them in one given place. You know, which would seem that would be all of them, but there's just so many characters going on in this movie. That I like that you get an impression of who's on stage and who's in the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, with the exception, the only person who I feel like I never understood, aside from the fact that he's there to be kooky, is Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because he just kind of, he's neat and all, and he just kind of drifts through.
But are you going to complain about Jeff Goldblum?
God, no. I love him in this movie. I love how absurd he looks and his gigantic low-riding bike.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. I do dig it. You mentioned the BBC correspondent Opal, and it's funny because on the one hand she seems to be after this story that we're talking about like America as an idea and as Nashville as a microcosm, But my God, does she ever seem to be missing the story?
Yeah. Well, because she filters it through her own, and granted, it's sort of, she's sort of set up as a straw man.
Yeah.
But it's through this old colonialist perspective. There's like one of my favorite bits in the movie is when she wakes up after sleeping the night with that that blonde guy.
Tom.
Yes, Tom. Yeah, I there's too many characters.
I will not fault you for not remembering.
But yeah, so she wakes up and she says, "For a moment, I thought I was in Israel, and it reminded me. It, you know, the decor looks nothing like it, and I don't know. It's very weird, but it reminded me of when I was." Spent a year on a kibbutz and I did all this work and it was such a wonderful time. And I'm like, what are you talking about, lady? Like, who are you even? Do you even know who you're talking to?
Yeah.
And, you know, in a way, it's a strange character. You could almost cut that character out of the movie
sure.
and it wouldn't bother her. But it does create the sense of, okay, so there is the outside of the United States that just completely doesn't get it at all. Like, never mind the country scene. She just doesn't get American society at all.
Right.
So it allows the country scene to kind of stand in for itself, yeah.
Well, for me, the scene that I always love with Opal is the scene where she's walking through the wrecking yard.
Is the wrecking yard also the school
also
buses?
Also the school buses. Well, yellow.
Fever.
See, but the thing about the wrecking yard is that if she was just like walking and filming, that scene would be brilliant. Because in a small way, she's kind of right about how it's a metaphor for America.
Yes.
But she over-explains it so... Like, I would just... But I'm thinking to myself, wow, like... Watching her walk along and just observe and pulling back and just seeing all these stacks and stacks of cars, I'm like, that's so cool. It's such a nice, but I'm like,
but she's
just
ruining
shut
it.
Up.
Yeah, she's ruining it. The school bus bit is great because I forget exactly what she's saying, but she's saying something, about like as a metaphor for the United States and how angry the buses look and whatever, and then she stops herself and goes, no, I need to do that again. More positive. No, more negative. It's just like...
Yeah, no, she's one of the things that really, really fueled the film for me. Another little connection to Broken Circle Breakdown is... I mentioned this with DDA, and there's one of the main characters in Nashville is Barbara Jean, the kind of... goddess of country music at the time, who we understand has had an accident and she's trying to like mount a comeback. So we see her, the first time we actually see her perform on stage to a proper audience, she kind of breaks, like she starts babbling, and ultimately like she just babbles her way off of the stage, like she can't get it back together. And it got me thinking that with that, looking at that, looking at DDA, I kind of feel that there are a few things lonelier than watching somebody break down on stage.
Oh, it's the worst. Yeah,
you know, it's not just that it makes us feel uncomfortable. Yeah. because it does, but
it's because the spotlight is on them. They're like, they're not literally alone, but there's just no one there to hold it. You want to give them a hug when that's happening. It's like when you see a comedian just completely bomb.
Yeah,
and it's like. You know, some people go, oh, that was terrible. Whereas I'm just like, oh my God, I feel so bad for that person.
And we see it here. Like, you know, and they're two completely different contexts. Like, one is just like, just kind of a mental lapse. The other one is just a complete angry break.
Yeah.
But they feel so similar in that you feel so bad for them. You feel wickedly uncomfortable. In the case of Barbara Jean, like, her band tries to get her out of it a few times. You know, DDA at least finally like snaps too. Barbara Jean has to be taken off stage, and it's just like every time I see it, it's just so, so sad.
You know, I think the ending of the film.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's an old film. I'm gonna spoil.
Go ahead.
Care.
Do it.
There's the assassination attempt. Altman lets that sequence play out, where. You know, the woman gets up to sing to try and kind of calm down the crowd, and it starts off extremely awkward, and you're not sure if it's going to work, and you kind of feel bad for the whole situation, but then it kind of catches on, and people realize, oh yeah, this is what we should do. This, you know, in this moment,
we should rally.
We should rally, and we should kind of comfort each other, and you know, take solace in each other and take solace in kind of bigger ideas. And you know, it, that's the whole thematic capper to the film.
Yeah.
It works really beautifully.
Well, and that's, that plays off of what, plays off of what Haven was trying to yell about, like, before he leaves the stage, right? He's like, this is Nashville. This isn't Dallas. Like, he uses Dallas, of course, because he's showing Dallas. He goes, this isn't Dallas. And I think in the back of his brain going, like, this isn't the rest of the country. Like, where, this is where we are the best people.
Right.
Like we...
But they're not. They're just people.
Exactly. But here's the thing. At the same time, like, she's able to do that, and she's able to rally them. I found it interesting that in that moment, so many of the big players we've watched over 2.5
disappear.
Hours just walk.
Yeah.
Like, they all just, like, they're just shell-shocked, and they just leave.
Yeah.
But the outsider who is trying to get in is the one who gets up and embodies what this city is supposed to be about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that scene. It's such a wicked end to this sprawling story that's not really, like, about something, and yet it's about so many things.
Yeah.
I love it as an ending. You know what? the one thing I kind of got to end this off with is, first of all, I got to thank everybody who pointed us towards Broken Circle Breakdown, because God knows if we would have seen it if you know, people hadn't have said, this is the movie we want you to talk about on episode 99. So I think Corey and I can both say thank you to everybody. We picked these movies blind. the other side. Now, like, just to kind of cap things off,
it's interesting how they connected.
It is. But were there any other films, like, after you watched Broken Circle Breakdown that you would have married it up with?
I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the one movie I thought of was Blue Valentine, but I don't like Blue Valentine, so I kind of...
Well, see, I do. Yeah. Like, either that or Rabbit Hole might have been one of the ones I went with.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly happy, because I like talking about Nashville more than Blue Valentine. Even though I like both those movies a lot, I find that the musical connection is much more there.
Yeah.
Some of those would have been mine, or, you know, like, your first suggestion was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. I could have ran with that, especially the bluegrass connection.
Yeah. I think the other two films fit better, but, you know, if you want bluegrass, you don't get much better.
That's episode 99 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, December 2nd. It's the 100th episode. I have something special in the works for that. Where are you writing these days, if people can find you, or are you writing?
These days I'm not really writing. I mean, here and there I do write for Dork Shelf. Sam Fragoso at Movie Mezzanine keeps bugging me to write something. Maybe one day
you too,
I will.
Huh?
maybe one day I will. And but, you know, I'm on Twitter writing way too much.
Where can people find you on Twitter?
At Coryatad, Coreyatad.
Very cool. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry, Apple's podcasting app. I'm on Stitcher Radio, and you can download episodes through the iTunes store. They'll give you many ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Be back on Broken Circle Breakdown, A Mighty Wind, or Nashville. It can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email Ryan at thematinee.ca, Facebook, where it's facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, where I'm at matinee_ca. Any final thoughts, buddy?
No, that's it.
99 shows. For Corey, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.
Cheers.